Education.
Good morning. The appellants in this case are the parents, children, voters, and the Board of Education of the City of St. Louis. Those children are students in the St. Louis Public Schools. The appellants are their parents, who are also board members who were elected in 2006 and 2007. The issues in this case are twofold. One, the way the operation of the statutes involved work, if the State Board of Education's decision to unaccredit the school district is invalid, or the statutory framework that was used to oust the school board members is unconstitutional, then this transfer of power that was affected by the State Board of Education must fail, and the Board of Education members should be reinstated with their full authority. The answer to both of those questions are the unaccreditation decision of the State Board is invalid, and the statutory framework by the General Assembly in 162.1100 violates not only Article 1, Section 25 of the Missouri Constitution, with the right to vote given to its citizens, but also Article 7, Section 12, which gives public officers the right to hold their term of office for which they were elected. The reason the State Board decision for unaccredited status is invalid is because they didn't follow their rules in deciding the accreditation of the St. Louis Public Schools. In 2006, when the State Board decided to begin to implement this ouster, DESE had changed its rules and did not publish or properly provide for our rules, and the State Board rules that were in effect were not followed by the State Board. The State Board rule is found in Exhibit 1, which is the published rule, and it says that the State Board shall determine accreditation status of all school districts based on three criteria, and it will do so in 5-year cycles. That wasn't done. The cycle was in the middle of the 5 years, and the State Board relied upon factors outside of its own rule in making a decision in March of 2006 that the City of St. Louis School Board, the public schools, should be found unaccredited.
Is there a different procedure required under the rules when an education school district is only provisionally accredited?
No. There is not.
What is the source of the 3-year review?
It's a 5-year review.
No, but when you've been provisionally accredited, I believe opposing counsel suggests that there's a review on a shorter term basis. What is the basis of the argument?
The State Board rule provides that there can be re-reviews at the State Board's discretion.
So
and they declared a State Board re-review, but only for performance, not for the other criteria that are set forth in the State Board.
And your argument as to why they're not permitted to do that is what? Are they not permitted to have a re-review? Is that your position?
I think they can have a re-review. Yeah, no, I don't believe that the State Board is precluded from having a re-review.
But they have to use all three.
But they have
criteria.
To follow their rule. If they're going to do that, and they didn't in this case. What the record in this case shows is they decided that the Board of Education would be unaccredited because of DESE's recommendation and analysis of the test scores, because of a turnover in superintendents, which is not included in their rule, and the financial condition of the St. Louis Board of Education, which is not included in their rule, and for which they agreed, which is part of the record, to those borrowings. And therefore, they didn't follow the rule. They relied on Dessy's rule, which Judge Callahan found was an invalid rule. And under the teachings of this court in Little Hills, an agency that makes a decision based on an invalid rule, that decision is void. And that decision is void here. If I could turn briefly to the constitutional arguments that we've raised. This statutory framework and the decisions that occurred in 2006 is a post-nullification of the voters' rights in the city of St. Louis to elect their school board members. There have been tumultuous times in the city of St. Louis. There was a majority of board members who took the board in a certain took the school district in a certain direction. And the parents of the children who were attending that school took issue with that direction. And they went out and they campaigned. They solicited voter support. And in 2006, two of those parents were elected to the board. And in 2007, two more of those parents were elected to the board. What the state board did and what this statute has in its application does is to totally nullify the decisions of the voters in the city of St. Louis to have those parents make educational policy for their children.
At the time they were elected, the statutes were in effect that authorized the transfer of authority.
Sure, and so
that,
was
and
the
that's the arguments that
that's
they,
their argument. So was the constitutional provision that voters' votes will be meaningful. And I don't believe that this statute, which I believe is unconstitutional, you have to remember, Justice Breckinridge, these four board members, the 2006 and 2007 board members, had no part in any of the activity for which the state board found to be deficient.
But is your argument that every time new members are elected to a governing board, that action, that the board can't suffer consequences for its current status because these new people didn't have involvement?
I won't disagree that malfeasance or a waste of funds or some activity which is immoral or improper cannot be the subject of sanction toward board members. That isn't the case here. These board members didn't participate in any of the actions.
But no action was taken against the individual members. It was against the board as an entity, wasn't it?
These members were, they were removed from office. And if this court wants to accept that the giving of monitoring and auditing provisions with no resources, and which is equal to what the SAB has and are subject to the SAB's decision as to whether or not it's going to provide information. If this court is going to embrace that they have retained office for which those voters elected them to,
Isn't there a significant legal difference between removing an individual board member and taking action against the board as an entity? Because there was no action directed at the individual board members in this circumstance, was there?
Well, I submit there was. They have absolutely no input in the policy decisions.
You're saying a consequence of the state board's transfer of power impacted them, but the transfer was from the board as an entity, not from the individual office holders, was it?
I guess I would dispute that consequence can be separated out from what happened. The Board of Education, which is the entity, also suffered because it doesn't have any power at all. It has none whatsoever. And I don't believe that Well, I don't believe that that supports the constitutional provisions either.
Is this the first one of these? Take the appointing of a board?
Well, we cited what happened in Illinois.
No, I mean in Missouri.
As far as I know, Your Honor, yes. I think this is a matter of first impression that this court needs to look at as to whether or not the General Assembly can enact a statutory framework that removes a governmental entity and its members who were voted into office by this type of statutory framework that has no relationship between the board that was removed from power from the conduct and the acts in which the state board was relying
on. Excuse me, but where does the Constitution draw this distinction you're asking us to draw between whether or not if these board members are prior board members that allegedly didn't properly administer the district, and you're saying if it was these board members, it's constitutional to have this provision, but if it's prior board members, it's not. And I'm unclear where you're drawing
that. No, I'm sorry, Judge Stiff. I wasn't trying to say that there was a distinction in that respect. I'm grounding my constitutional argument with regard to the office in Article 7, Section 12.
You're saying you could never take away authority from an elected board member constitutionally because you would be depriving voters of being governed by the people who they voted into office.
In circumstances as applied in this case,
that's correct. What are you talking about in circumstances? How is your constitutional argument depend on the facts of a particular case?
I believe that the constitutional provision that you get to hold office has its limits if you are committing immoral conduct or has some criminal activity and you're wasting public funds.
What if the office you're elected to, the provisions say you shall hold this office if you perform well, but should you perform particularly badly, then you shall be replaced by a different board? Isn't that what the voters voted for? I mean, if those statutes were in place at the time these people were elected, can you explain to me why it takes away their right to vote?
Well, the right to vote was there at the time they voted these officers into office, too. And so
they voted them, for instance, only for the term of office set out in the statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And were the powers that were set out in the statute? They only had the powers given to them by statute, the board
members.
So if I understand your argument, or to take it maybe one step further, is that the corrective to what the board had done in terms of mismanagement or whatever was done by the voters when they elected new board?
Correct. And that's what yes, Judge Wolf. Everything that happens throughout this state, if board members are not performing, then voters come in and vote new board members in.
And then the question, I suppose, is whether or not the legislature can fashion what is in effect a receivership remedy for the entity, irrespective of whether the voters have corrected or not corrected. This is in effect a receivership, isn't it?
It is a total removal of an entity from control over the district and giving it to a new entity, which you could liken to a receiver.
Because there is I don't know if it's like a receivership, but it does. I take it that this three-person board does take its cues from the State Board of Education to a certain degree. So it's in effect kind of a state takeover of the entity.
Well, I think it is a state takeover.
Yeah.
Although the state didn't take responsibility for it. It gave it to three appointed board members.
Two of which are appointed by local
officials. Correct. Okay. And one by the governor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thanks.
May it please the court. The troubles of large urban school districts are desperately difficult, and not just in Missouri and not just in St. Louis in Missouri, but across this state and across the country. In 1998, the Missouri General Assembly took up the question of how to restore local control and state control to the St. Louis school children's, their district, back to their parents and their community and their state. After almost a generation of federal court supervision, the legislature stepped up and enacted Senate Bill 781 to provide the tools to author a settlement of that long-running desegregation lawsuit in St. Louis. That statute, that bill in 1998, was a very carefully crafted compromise between many competing ideologies and many competing political points of view from legislators around the state, urban and rural, west and east. And it met the basic needs of providing $60 million a year in new money for the St. Louis City School District that would be needed to supplant the funding that had been ordered by the federal district court for so many years.
But that was quite apart from the question of whether or not the school board, the elected school board, could be displaced by an administrative court.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it was quite apart from it, and I think that's the point. That the both those provisions were in Senate Bill 781, and we cannot now know with any certainty, but I think it is fair to assume that all of the provisions in Senate Bill 781 were necessary to crafting the majorities needed to pass that bill. And the contingency enacted in Senate Bill 781 for a change of control from the elected school board in St. Louis to a three-person special administrative board and the transitional school district was added to that bill, and it was specifically acknowledged by the St. Louis School District in the settlement that was written after Senate Bill 781 was enacted and signed by them and approved by the federal district court. The fact that that statute would cause a change of control if the district were to lose accreditation in the future was specifically acknowledged by the school district in that settlement. And here we are nearly 10 years later. That provision is finally triggered, and the school board is reneging on that provision of the settlement and backing out of that portion of Senate Bill 781.
But this isn't here as a contract dispute. It's here as a constitutional issue.
I agree, but I think that context is significant in this case. As a constitutional claim, I think Your Honors have already highlighted some of the significant problems that they have. And there are many others. First and foremost, the voters' rights claim simply can't survive the fact that every person who ran for the school board and every voter who voted for any candidate for school board knew or was deemed to know that the school board itself and its members would have only the powers that the legislature gave them, and that the contingency for a removal of those powers was there sitting in the law, untriggered, but nonetheless present from 1998 on. So for them to say that in 2006, when two of the plaintiffs were elected, that the voters' expectations were somehow frustrated when less than 2 years later, the powers, many of the powers of the school board were transferred to the transitional school district, can't withstand scrutiny when you look at what it is the voters either knew or were deemed to know and what the candidates themselves knew or were deemed to know. Even more so with the two that were elected in 2007, because that election occurred after the school district had already been found to be unaccredited. And in the context of what would happen as a result of that finding when it became effective in June. So there could have been no confusion as to those two plaintiffs that what they were elected to was an office that would for the moment exercise limited powers. The one thing that the plaintiffs have consistently overlooked in this case and downplayed in this case is the most significant role now being played by the elected board in St. Louis is not the auditing and public reporting powers that they retained under Senate Bill 781, but the fact that they are there when control reverts back to them. This was never intended to be a permanent change of control. The statute in Senate Bill 781, 162-1100, very clearly contemplates that control would revert back to the elected board, restoring local control of school districts.
Is there some projection as to when that would occur?
The State Board of Education, by statute, looks at this in three-year chunks. The first statutory moment for the transitional school district to lapse would have occurred earlier this year, and the State Board of Education extended that. But whenever they view that the purposes of the transitional school district have been met, they can dissolve it, and that dissolution will transfer automatically the powers back to the
when
elected school board.
How do you know? What are the criteria for knowing that?
The 1100 sets out the what it is that the transitional school district is there to accomplish. Whether, when, and how the State Board of Education will make the determinations as to the extent to which they've been accomplished, and I'm looking now at Section 12 of 162-1100, we haven't seen yet. The transitional district was initially created in 1998 and subsequently dissolved, but it was dissolved pursuant to the settlement agreement, and there were no findings at that time. It was reestablished pursuant to 1100 and the settlement agreement early in 2007, so that it was there in July of 2007, excuse me, June of 2007, when the...
Did this particular transitional school board bring with it a funding stream? The original one you talked about being dissolved brought with it a funding stream.
One of the purposes of the original one was to put before the voters a sales tax. Because one of the most significant things in Senate Bill 781 was that it allowed St. Louis, unlike every other school district in the state, to count a sales tax as part of its local effort, as though it were a property tax. And the sales tax that was being used in that calculation was put to the voters by the Special Administrative Board of the Transitional School District back in 99, but they, today, Your Honor, to answer your question, they bring with them the same stream of income that the elected school board had to administer. When they assume the powers and the administration of the district, they take control with that change of control over all of the assets.
What happened to the sales tax? Is that still in effect and was with the elected school board?
Yeah, the sales tax remained in effect as part of the settlement, and also under Section 162-1100, that was assigned back to the elected board, and then by operation of the change of control in 1100 subsection 3, gets not directly assigned, because the powers to administer those funds automatically go to the transitional district now. So
the issues we're talking about are management issues, not funding issues.
Right. There are no funding issues here. The money follows the children, and it follows the district. What we're talking about is two groups of managers of the district, and those are distinct legal entities. The school district exists. It is managed by the school board of St. Louis up until June 15th of 2007, and by the SAB of the transitional district from that point forward, but the district is still there.
Your opponent argues that this is special legislation, that Senate Bill 781 affects the school district, not St. Louis, not the city, which we have historically recognized as acceptable classification. Is there substantial justification for why the state used the school district of the city of St. Louis?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is. First, in order to solve the problem that the legislature had to deal with in 1998, they had to deal with the school district and the board, not the city, as a political subdivision. The political subdivisions that were at issue were the district and the school board. So there was no way to craft a bill that, that dealt with the city as city. The use of that phrase in this statute and in many, many, many others is a geographical limitation rather than an identifier of a specific political subdivision. And there is nothing in the prior cases of this court that indicates that there's any distinction between using a city, not in a county, as a reference of a single specific political subdivision rather than as a geographical identifier of some other political subdivision or some group of people or some group of businesses. Statutes use that phrase to limit the application of a statute or an exception in a statute for all those reasons. And this court in the Treadway case dealt with a series of regulations and statutes for emissions and auto emissions testing that had nothing to do with the political subdivision of St. Louis itself. Instead, what was at issue was the use of this phrase, city not within a county, in identifying where these rules would apply and to whom they would apply within this geographical area. And in fact, it wasn't only city of St. Louis, it was the metropolitan area. And still, this court found that the historical exception to the special law doctrine that this court has always recognized didn't draw a distinction between its use geographically and its use to identify only the city of St. Louis as a political subdivision. There isn't any logical reason to do that. There isn't any legal basis in this court's prior opinions, and there's certainly nothing in the Constitution that would require that distinction. And in fact, the Constitution uses the phrase city not within a county in at least a couple of places. And when it does that, it's not referring to the city of St. Louis. It's referring to, in one instance, the sewer and water districts, and in the other instance, the location where certain former probate judges would have been found and the expenses that were associated with them and who will pay them. So there isn't any reason in the Constitution text itself to adopt the rule that they would have this court adopt. And of course, it would leave not only the state of the law in Missouri in chaos as we sort through the hundreds of statutes that use that phrase, and not only would it leave his client, the school board, out of existence because their own statute uses that phrase, but it leaves the legislature without the ability that it's going to have in the future to deal again with these questions of large urban school districts and how to solve them. This can't be done with a cookie cutter.
I'm not sure which of you would be the best to address it, but someone needs to address the issue of the rule. And you're saying the statute sets out procedures whereby authority can be transferred back to the school district from the special board, or the school board. But the school board says you didn't use the statutory procedures to take authority away. What gives you that authority?
I'll address those, and Mr. Munich is here, and his client, the Special Administrative Board, to deal with questions, if the court has any, on the claim that if all of this transfer of power is constitutional and effective, whether or not their claim that it's limited has any merit, and we think it isn't, and it's addressed in both our briefs. The question as to the validity of the rule that they've raised, first of all, the manual at issue, and it's in their exhibit, and I think it's important that at least we get it in front of us. It begins at their appendix 100, the appellant's appendix at page 100. That's a publication that DESE puts out. It changes every year. It's a guide to understanding your annual performance report. It's used by school districts to understand a report that DESE creates every year for every district.
But doesn't it set out criteria and you have to meet a certain number in order to be accredited, and it's never been published as a rule? The allegation.
And Your Honor, that is the basic point, and I'm nearing out of time. So let me say that the effect of meeting or not meeting any number of those is nothing. It has no legal effect. It will control the recommendation they make to the state board for the subset of school districts each year that go before the state board for accreditation decisions. It's how DESE reaches their recommendation, and it's fair to tell the districts in advance how they will do that. But it doesn't control what the state board will do, and it's the state board that makes the decision as to whether to find them accredited or not.
So is there no separate obligation on the part of DESE to, if it uses this as a statement of general applicability, and it's what it will use in deciding whether or not a district should, it should recommend the districts be accredited or not, why is not that something that it needs to publish as a rule, as the trial court found?
Your Honor, I think that would be a lovely case to argue whether it had that obligation or not. That's not this case, because what they're after is to find a State Board of Education decision invalid and unwind this change of control. That certainly doesn't necessarily follow, and I don't think it even legally or logically follows from whatever they claim DESE over here failed to do with the rule. So could there be a lawsuit between a school district and the State Board where that issue could be hammered out, and we could argue the issues of standing and the other things we've raised in this lawsuit? Yes, and the outcome would be either a need for them to promulgate it or stop using it, or to tell the plaintiffs to go away. But the outcome wouldn't be what we're talking about in this case, which is invalidating a decision of an entirely separate and superior constitutionally created body, the State Board of Education.
Thank you, Counsel. And the time is up, but I'll give you 2 minutes if you want to quickly address
that. Thank you, Your Honor.
The only proper conclusion to the question of assuming that the change of control was effective on June 15, 2007, and who bore what authority thereafter is the conclusion reached by the trial court here, which is namely that the Special Administrative Board, my client, took control essentially of all the powers of the elected board that are set forth in Section 621 of Chapter 162, reserving to the elected board, to Mr. Brassman's client, the duties of publicly reporting and auditing. It's made very clear in Section 621, which is entitled Powers and Duties of Board of Education, Special Administrative Board. It sets forth that the Board of Education shall have general and supervising control and exercise all management and all authority over the school district. Subsection 2 says that on the occasion of the lack of accreditation and the creation of a Special Administrative Board, all those powers then flow to the Special Administrative Board, save for those powers of auditing and public reporting. To reach an opposite conclusion, to say here that the Board of Education and the state legislature took the admittedly significant, very significant step of removing this elected board from the governance of the district, only to say, on the other hand, well, we're going to give you some authority relating to the desegregation sales tax and to debt service levy, is to destroy the entire intent of the legislative scheme here, which was clearly to try something new when things that were in place there weren't working. And so we would submit, Your Honors, that the only way properly to read these statutes is as the trial court did. The appellant relies on this language in Section 1100, the date language, August 28, 1998, which was the effective date of Senate Bill 781. Both these sections are part of that, to say, well, somehow that relates back to language earlier in that clause talking about duties. That is an improper interpretation of that statute. It's a tortured interpretation of the statute, as the trial court said. I believe the state's brief sets out in quite concise and persuasive detail why that modifying language is intended to say, which district are we talking about? It is a district in a city within a county on, existing on 8/28/98. That language does not go back to talk to the powers or duties. And in any event, Section 621 makes it entirely clear that all the powers and duties, save for the public reporting and auditing, revert to the SAB on June 15, 2007.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Exhibit 2 in the record is the MSIP standards that the State Board adopted and incorporated into Exhibit 1, which is their rule. So their MSIP standards rule addresses 9.3 and 9.4, which are the two areas that DESE evaluated and said did not meet its criteria. Those standards, Exhibit 2, the MSIP standards of the state board's rule, says that a school district meets the accreditation if the scores are high or increasing. The record in this case is not controverted that those scores were increasing. So by the state board's own rule, the MSIP rule, the city school board met that criteria.
Is there no room for judgment on the part of the board? It's simply a mechanical application of whether or not that standard's met.
Well, their rule is higher increasing, and so we included in there, if increasing doesn't mean increasing objectively, then it's vague. Then it wouldn't be enforceable because there's no criteria at all. The evidence in this record was it was increasing. Therefore, you would think that that would then satisfy the state board's rule. But what the state board did was rely on DESE's rule, the invalid rule, in its analysis of what 9.3 and 9.4 meant, what increasing meant. And that makes it void and invalid as well. The state board can't have it both ways. It has a rule. It can't say they don't have to follow DESE, but in practice, that's what they did. They followed the presentation at the March state board meeting was DESE with a slideshow explaining why the city school board scores under 9.3 and 9.4 didn't meet DESE's requirement, and the state board said they're unaccredited. That was the reason. They didn't say they weren't increasing or that they weren't high. They didn't follow their rule. It's an invalid decision, and it's void. This is special legislation. This legislation, all the comments about the city not within a county refer to the city of St. Louis, and this court has addressed many times the constitutional provisions of the city and why that is different. This statute applies to an existing school board in a city not within a county. It applies to the city of St. Louis and the city of St. Louis school board only. That's what it was intended to do. That's the effect of it. It's special legislation. It doesn't apply to any school district in this state except the city school board. 781 had a conglomeration of provisions to settle the DSEG case. Two of those provisions that were added on, the election of board members by subdistricts was found by this court to be unconstitutionally vague. There was also a provision in 781 that was added on to muster the votes that said that the Student Bill of Rights to transform all school districts into K through 8 grades should be done. This court found that to be unconstitutional as well. So there are parts of 781. I didn't know we were going to talk about the DSEG settlement agreement, but 781 goes way beyond settling the DSEG case. There were a lot of provisions in there that were added, including this one, which is unconstitutional and nullifies the city of St. Louis voters in electing their school board members. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.